Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. We are joined today by Matt Robert. Matt runs multiple recovery-oriented groups in the greater Boston area in the US. Some are open to the public, some are in detoxes, psychiatric units and shelters, etc. He uses the platform of Smart Recovery, that is self-management and recovery training, and the basic thrust of his groups is about helping people examine their intention and motivation to change. The groups include people with substance use issues, as well as any behaviour with undesired negative consequences that build up over time and get in the way of living one's life as desired. He also does this in the context of hybrid 12-step groups that incorporate mindfulness, meditation and Buddhist philosophy. And so this is what we're going to roughly be talking about today. So hello, Matt. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Hi, Barry. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Matt. Good. Okay, well, could you begin, Matt, by maybe telling us a bit about your background and how you got involved in this field of work?
I got involved, you know, I'd been, like a lot of people, I started using drugs and alcohol when I was a teenager. And I had noticed that, you know, I didn't become a heroin addict or anything right away, or an alcoholic, but I noticed when the first time that I took drugs that it did something for me, in the sense that I was an anxious kid and I was kind of depressed and had a hard time socially, at least internally. I felt like I was having a hard time. And the fact that I could feel different really struck me when it happened for the first time. So the first time, like, I took drugs, I was in Mrs. Mummy's history class, and she was this old bag that hit people with rulers, and she was really mean, and it was really frustrating for me and boring. And this kid threw me these three pills one day, and they were Percodan, which is like oxycodone. And I just noticed that I was like, oh, in about 20 minutes, I was like, I can do this. You know, this isn't so bad. Because I didn't know I could feel different. I thought the way I was a young kid, I thought I was always going to feel anxious and depressed, and that was the normal way to feel. So that was really a marked effect for me. And so I think my midbrain and everything else in my psyche remembered that later on. And so when I started, you know, I kept drinking the way people normally do in their teens and 20s. Going through college and partying and that kind of thing. But then it kind of hung on and eventually got to the point where it became very serious. And I think a lot of it was, you know, there was an underlying depression along with it. So that's one of the things that was motivating my use. And then, and I quit, you know, here and there in different places in my life. But I finally, you know, it got to the point where some serious things were happening in my life. I had some medical issues where I had a surgical infection, and I was they wanted to amputate my leg for a while. There was a lot of difficulties with septicemia and things like that. I almost died a couple of times. And so at that point, that's when I really started to get addicted to opiates for pain management, and sort of felt myself slide into addiction, in the sense that, you know, I was running out of my prescriptions, would run out early, and things like that. And I started mixing them with alcohol to make them more potent, that type of thing. And now in retrospect, now that I'm in recovery, I realize, you know, I was always tempted to go to the street to get, because heroin is pretty easy to get. It's really easy around here now, but at that time it was pretty easy to get. And I realized now there was probably something in my brain telling me, you know, if you do that, you're going to be dead, because you're just going to, you know, that's kind of how I got into the whole addiction thing. And, at the end, when I finally got clean, going through programs after programs, and I go through into a program, and then I would do great, and I'd start my own little subgroups and meditation groups and things like that in the program, and I'd get out, and then I'd relapse. So finally, some a counselor that really was paying attention said, you know, there's something else going on. You need to go into a dual diagnosis program, and I did that. And a nurse practitioner there was very astute, and we figured out that my father, who was suffering from late stage Parkinson's, was on an antidepressant that was helping him that that I hadn't tried, and I had been on several different antidepressants to try to work on my depression, and so we switched me to that antidepressant, and it was like I changed overnight. But even then, you know, even then I got the leg up I needed to do the things I needed to do to get sober. I didn't get sober right away, but and that at that point I really started, you know, I was really serious about staying sober. Yeah. And I still would notice, like, every, you know, 6 weeks or so, the habit pattern was so ingrained. Every once in a while my brain would go off and say, you know, it's probably okay. Go out, you know, I'd go out and get shattered for a day, and I'd be like, why did I do that? And then I'd get back on the horse, and it would happen again in about another couple of months. And that went on for 3 years, and it finally wore out like an old record, but it made me realize, you know, that this is, it's a really deeply ingrained habit that's associated with the reward system of the brain. And that's what makes this so difficult. And it was really important for me to be in, you know, I'm not really pro or anti 12 step or SMART or, I'm really, this is where the open source sobriety thing comes in. It's really, my thing is like trying to help people figure out, what's going to work for them, because everybody's development is different. We all come from different situations in the world, and we all going out to different stressors and different situations out in the world, and everybody's recovery is going to look different.
Is that what open source means?
Well, it comes from, I sort of borrowed it from, I don't know if you heard of open source software.
Yeah, like Linux.
Yeah, Linux, however they say it. Yeah. And when they started the internet, there were a group of programmers and stuff who didn't want it to become a very proprietary thing where people were making a lot of money and selling software and things. They wanted it to be free, so people could take whatever they wanted, pieces of this and that, to build whatever type of website or business that they wanted to on the internet. And that's kind of how I feel about recovery. You know, you can take little bits of, okay, this sounds good to me. Like meditation and yoga is working for me, and psychotherapy, and maybe I need some medication, you know, whatever is going to work for you. And that's kind of where the journey is in recovery, is figuring out what those things are.
And do you see yourself, Ben, as a role as a facilitator in that sense, that people come to you help them find their way then in many ways?
Yes. Yeah. Because I, you know, it never really worked. People, when they wag their finger in my face and say, if you don't do this, you know, that never really worked for me. And it doesn't work for most people. You know, you have to figure out what's going to work for you on your own. And that, you know, if that's when people have been using for a long time as a coping mechanism, that it takes a while to figure out what you're going to substitute that negative habit, you know, what you're going to put in place.
Yeah. Sure. Okay.
Because it leaves a big hole, you know, yeah. When you got to fill it with something.
So what do you personally think about the term recovery, Matt?
I think it's inaccurate, excuse me, an inaccurate term, in the sense that we're not really, in the lay sense of the term recovery is more, you know, you're getting something back. There's also a really negative term of, you know, like you recover bodies from wreckage, and, you know, there's a lot of things like that where how it's used, but basically it means you're coming back to a state that you're coming back to a state that you were before. When you go into the recovery room after surgery, you know, you get your strength back, and you're returning to the state that you were in before you had to have your appendix out or something like that.
Yeah.
And I think in addiction, the recovery process is really more about negotiating change. Because when you get through, when you have a really deeply ingrained habit pattern like addiction, you're not the same person you were if you get out the other side of it, you know. And you've become a changed person, hopefully for the better. You learn something about yourself and about your perseverance and what's important to you and what you can do in your life. And so it, to me, it's more about, and a lot of times I'll ask in my groups, I'll ask people, so what's the opposite of addiction to you? Instead of say, terming it in terms of recovery. And a lot of times people will say, and this is one that I really like, is, you know, connection or reconnection. You're reconnecting with your life, or balance, right? It's in the middle way, you know, your middle way path. It's like it's in between the extremes. You find balance so that you're going down the middle again.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Would you say there's a similar thing? I've read one of your blogs where you're writing about the term addict. Would you say that that term is also loaded in the similar way like recovery is, in a, you know, it can have negative connotations?
Absolutely. And you know, you know, there's this, the way that we use addiction in a positive way these days is sort of like a euphemism. Like people say, I'm addicted to tennis, you know, because I play, you know, I do this all the time. And I think even in Shakespearean times, the term, I think that's about when it started, but the term addiction really didn't mean something negative. It meant something more like a person's bent or a certain personality characteristic about the way somebody acted or behaved. It didn't really, it had a neutral kind of connotation. And it wasn't until the 20th century where it really took on this meaning of having these behaviors that you repeated over and over again with these negative consequences, and you kept doing it despite how bad the consequences were. So I think there's a really positive side to addiction. I mean, when you look at how it's this hyper focus and attention to something, and I've talked about this in a couple of blogs too, you know, if Thomas Edison wasn't addicted to like doing experiments on things, or Mozart wasn't addicted to music, you know, where would we be? You know, those people were really obsessed with what they were doing in a positive way.
Yeah, it's like Einstein had one thought for about 6 years, didn't he? You know.
yeah, exactly. And that's basically, I mean, the same process that the brain's going through. It's hyper-focused on this certain train of thought. So I think the term addiction is not, you know, it's become this negative word, but it's not necessarily a negative thing, except when you're doing these negative behaviors over and over again, and despite all the horrible results that are happening.
So how can this be detrimental then in certain detox-type facilities where people are supposed to say, I am such and such a person, I am an addict? What's the rationale behind that, and how can that be? Doesn't sound very helpful somehow.
It's not helpful. I feel pretty strongly about that. Now, in SMART, we don't tell people are free to label themselves whatever they want. They can just say their name. Also, a lot of people that come into SMART also do 12-step meetings where they've learned how to label themselves as an addict. And so we don't, you know, we don't say you can't do that. That's wrong. If people want to do that, that's okay. But to me personally, I feel like, you know, when AA started, it was people were getting thrown in jail or in insane asylums. You know, they weren't getting treatment. And so when the AA movement first started, there were a lot of things in it that were very positive about people identifying themselves as addicts and alcoholics and recognizing that it was a disease. At that point, it being a disease was a positive thing because it was less stigmatizing. Now, the disease model is getting re-stigmatized, I think, in a lot of ways, but that's another story. But anyway, calling yourself, to me, using the term addict for myself, it was like, why, we've learned something about psychology since 1935. And one of the things that we know, it's like calling yourself the thing that you're trying not to be is usually not a very productive enterprise. So if I'm calling myself a loser or, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And if I'm in treatment for addiction, I don't want to be an addict. I don't want to be an alcoholic. Why would I call myself that? So to me, that's why it's counterintuitive.
Okay. Does it help some people?
It does help some people. Some people, it like keeps it real. It keeps it up front. And it also, there's a level of honesty that it helps some people with. And honesty is a really important thing in recovery from addiction and at all levels. Because if you're not honest with yourself, then it's really hard to be able to look at what you're telling yourself and say, really, I just got a detox and I want to go to the liquor store. I don't, that's kind of a counterintuitive thing. So I think when people are labeling themselves, I think it's important for them to recognize, is it helpful or is it not helpful? For example, if I was in detox and people end up in detox and it's like it's a shock. You're like, how did I end up here? What am I doing with my life? There's this vulnerability and this openness to like what is happening to my life that's very important. And so when somebody comes in and says, you need to call yourself an addict or an alcoholic when you're saying, that's counterintuitive. And then somebody else comes in and says, no, you shouldn't do that. You should do this. You get all these mixed messages. It's really not helpful. But when I was in detox, I think it was important for me to keep it, okay, yeah, the reason you're in here is because you overdosed and you are you're having a problem with drugs and alcohol. So yeah, calling yourself an addict or an alcoholic in detox is probably a good thing. But then 6 months down the road, if you're calling yourself the thing you're trying not to be, it doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah. No, I can see that, Matt. Okay, so you've mentioned mindfulness a couple of times, Matt. So how can that help with addiction?
Well, mindfulness, like a really basic definition of mindfulness, is to be paying attention to what you're telling yourself, what's going on in your mind.
Yeah.
And when someone's in addiction and having this turmoil of ideas of like, I want to do something, but I know I'm not supposed to do it. I want to do something, but I know I can't do it because I'm going to get arrested or I'm going to lose my family or, whatever the consequences are up to that point. It's important to be able to pay attention to what you're telling yourself, because if you can't change something if you don't know what it is. I know that sounds trivially obvious, but I mean, it's true.
Yeah.
If you're not paying attention to what's happening around you, you don't have as much control over what's happening, at least in your response to it. And so that's what I like about mindfulness is, and I do it in my groups. And, a lot of times in SMART meetings, there's a checkout where people talk about what they're going to do during the week, or there's homework that people get assigned. I often do a mindfulness exercise, a body, breath, and mind exercise, where people kind of stretch because they've been sitting for an hour and so they don't fall asleep when they're meditating. So we do a little stretching and then we do some breathing exercises that are helpful in relaxing the body and bringing your attention, your focus to the breathing. But so in mindfulness, essentially you're focusing your mind on a single thing, either it's the breathing or a sound or a mantra that you repeat in your mind, or like a candlelight or a fixed point. You're focusing your mind on a single point, and basically, I mean, what the Buddhists call it, actually, it's called lojong. It's mind training. And in fact, the way that word translates is actually more about attitude training. So what you're doing when you sit in meditation, you're watching your mind, you're looking at all these thoughts that arise and emotions and things, and you get, we don't, as a Western culture, we don't do that. We don't just sit down quietly and close our eyes and look at our minds.
Yeah.
And if you practice doing it, you get better at recognizing thoughts and things as more like they're discrete objects and things that you can see, you can predict when they're going to come and predict when you can see them on the horizon. So like an urge or something like that that's involved in addiction, you can see those kind of problematic things as they're coming up and maybe do something to control them better. And it's called a practice just because you have to practice doing it. If you just do it every once in a while, it doesn't have that effect. But if you do it regularly, I mean, it's more important to do it regularly, like for short periods every day, than to do a whole bunch of it like on a weekend or something, because your brain gets better at recognizing those types of things.
And so you're talking about the aspects of noticing there, but do you think also mindfulness helps you to maybe respond to being sort of hijacked emotionally rather than just reacting to it as well?
Yeah, this is the other aspect of it. It's not just looking at what you're telling yourself. It's noticing, like you said, it's noticing what you're telling yourself without judgment or forming any type of opinion or emotional attachment or getting agitated anyway. You just notice your thoughts. And then you let them go, and then you come back to the present moment. You come back to the breath or whatever you're focusing on. You come back to the room that you're in. You come back to the present moment. That's what the whole idea of the present moment, being in the present moment, is.
Okay. But then with regard to dealing with addiction, is being in the present moment always a good thing?
Yes. And I'm gonna stick my neck out, and people will say, well, if I'm in this giant party and people are putting beers in front of me, and they're, you know, and I'm really agitated and I'm upset and I'm in early recovery, you know, is that really? But I think it is, because what you're doing is, and this is important in early recovery. Sometimes, you know, if you know that you're going to be going into a situation that's going to be emotionally loaded and was triggering in the past. And if your mind is telling you, you know, this is really not a good idea, I really am not feeling comfortable about this, then you can take steps to, you can either decide, okay, I can't go to this thing, I can't go to this function, or I need to bring somebody with me to have an out or some kind of escape plan that I can get out if I'm feeling triggered or vulnerable in some way. So, I think it's important to be able to notice what you're feeling. And the more that you do it and you don't attach emotions to the thoughts and the feelings that are coming at you, the more you're able to see them for what they are and respond to them instead of react to them.
Yeah. Okay. When you were talking about your own experience, what I found interesting was that you mentioned that you had a few relapses, but you didn't beat yourself up about it. You just sort of got on the horse again and tried again, you know, rather than saying, oh, fuck it, this is it.
Yep.
What's the difference between a relapse in that sense and a prelapse?
Okay. I think there's a difference between people, and some people don't think there's a difference between this, but there's a difference between a slip and a relapse. And a slip is something that happens accidentally.
Okay.
You know, we'll say that nothing happens accidentally. Well, no, things can happen. Somebody can put a drink in your hand or you're looking the other way and you'll put it up to your mouth and you'll take a sip of it. It's about intention. So if you're not intending to drink or to use drugs, if you're not intending to do it, then your sobriety is secure. So having a slip is not a bad thing. A prelapse is when there's something that's been triggering you and you're setting yourself up for a relapse. Like most people will say in the recovery communities, you know, you're thinking about a relapse way before it happens. You're planning it in your mind. It can be a week ahead of time. You go, okay, the wife's going to be out of town this weekend, and so I can get, you know, I can hide something in the bed. You know, there's all kinds of things that you can catch your mind doing that's prelapse. That's when you can catch yourself sort of planning to set yourself up for a relapse. That's prelapses.
Is it also sometimes almost on a subconscious level? You just sort of happen to find yourself in a particular place where you know you can gain access to the things you want.
And... Oh, yeah, absolutely. And there's so many associations with, you know, sometimes people will be like, I don't know what happened. It just kind of happened. And they're in somebody's house that they used to, you know, like 2 years ago, they used to go to parties there and get drunk all the time. And their brain remembers everything about that, the associations with the behavior. So, but this is another reason why it's good to go, why am I feeling so triggered in this house? Oh yeah, this is where I use, you know, it's like paying attention to that stuff can really help you head things off at the pass in terms of something until it gets to the point where you're really, there's nothing else you can do. That is typically, you know, if you're doing that type of thing, you're doing a really positive way of making a choice. This is what Smart really talks about, is like everything is a choice that we make. So when people get really agitated and they're in very early recovery and they're trying not to use, and they don't, and Mark talks about this a lot, Mark Lewis, about, you know, being able to distract yourself when you're starting to feel really agitated, like you want to use. And I think it's important to distract yourself before you get to, and this is a very technical term, till you get a case of the fuckets. The fuckets are this thing where you get to that point, and it's like you can be frustrated working on your car, and you get, okay, F it, I'm not going to do this anymore, and then you take a break. The same thing happens in addiction. If you get to the point where you're at the F it's, and then you just say, F it, I'm going to go, you actually feel better because you've made a decision and you've calmed your brain down. Because it's not your midbrain and your frontal lobes are not going back and forth in this debate anymore about whether you should use or not. And so that it's a really important thing for people to notice. And this is, goes back to prelapse and relapse, to be able to notice, okay, I'm like approaching the efforts and I can see it on the horizon there. I need to do something to distract myself and take myself out of the situation or take myself out of this emotional space I'm in and go do something completely different.
Yeah, that reminds me, actually, I don't know if you're familiar with Walter Mischel's marshmallow test, you know, that. Well, that was he talked about the kids that were able to defer better, even at 3 or 4 years old. They used distraction techniques. They would put their hands over their eyes, or they would start dancing or something, not to look at the marshmallow, you know. And
And one of those blog posts, I one of the strategies, they have all kinds of acronyms in SMART, but this is one that I thought of myself, is because it's easy to remember, is POD, as in an escape pod to get out of the situation. You pause, you stop yourself, so you disengage your midbrain from your frontal lobes. You stop yourself so you don't have that impulsive, reflexive reaction. Observe what you're telling yourself. Really, it's a good, I want to go to the liquor store and I just got out of detox. Is that a good idea? No. And then you do something different, do something completely different than you normally would do. That's not, it doesn't have any associations with your past usage. So, you know, if you used to sit down in front of the TV to distract yourself, but that's what you always did in the past, no, don't do that. Go for a walk in the woods or do something, you know, that's completely not associated with your usage. So,
Well, I read that blog, Matt, and I just thought that's brilliant. And I've actually used that couple of times myself, because I have a guest house and I'm exposed to lots of food, walking past cupboards all the time with biscuits and crisps and things like that. And I do get tempted at times, and so I've been saying to myself, pause, and then it just gives you that time to sort of think, what am I telling myself, what sort of excuse am I giving myself to eat that biscuit, you know?
And you just actually disengage yourself from the habitual behavior, and before you get sucked into it, and then you can make a different choice.
At times
It's not a perfect, you know, nothing's perfect in this, but that's why it takes practice, you know.
Exactly. Okay, right now You've said that you find Buddhist ideas helpful at times in relation to this field. For example, could you tell us a bit about what you mean by beginner's mind and expert's mind?
Beginner's mind is more about when you think about when you first learn how to do something, you're totally open to all the different things that are happening around you. And let me give you a good example would be think about, and this is about automatic behavior and habitual behavior. Think about when, I don't know, if you've ever had a point in your life where you had to stop driving for a long period, like a year or two. I had a lot of surgeries and I had the surgical infection. I couldn't drive for a couple of years. And when I finally got in front of the wheel again, I remember being horrified because I saw everything. It's like, I have to keep track of my steering wheel and the brakes and the gas, and I have to look out for other, you know, it's like all the stuff that we take for granted because we do it automatically. That lasted for about maybe 5 minutes or 10 minutes. And there's in Mark's blog, he did this thing about there's a experiment these guys did with a backwards bike. I don't know if you're familiar with that one. Where so they had, it was a totally normal bike, except when you turn the handlebars to the right, the front wheel went to the left.
Okay, yeah.
And so this guy had to retrain his mind. Yeah. This is like a really good example of what happens in addiction and why it's important to just be abstinent. Because so he trained himself how to ride this bike. It took him like 9 months doing it a little bit every day. And then he finally learned how to ride the backwards bike.
Yeah.
And then he went to Amsterdam and he got on a regular bike and he couldn't ride it anymore. It was totally foreign to him. But like in 20 minutes, it was back. So it took like 8 months to ride the backwards bike, which could be a metaphor for recovery. When he got on the regular bike, it didn't take him long at all. Yeah. And that's what happens with addiction. Those pathways are all still in there.
In there, yeah. And that's good to know that, isn't it?
Yeah. So beginner's mind, you're still able to look at things like at all the potentials in a situation, all the possibilities, everything that you do. So maybe, you know, you're learning how to drive the car again and you'll see, you know, this is a better way to do this. This makes more sense if I put my foot in this position or I do this. It's like you always look at a new situation as if it was like you came to it for the first time.
Are you also saying, though, that you're more open to sort of disconfirming evidence as well, that it's a more sort of provisional outlook, that you're open to the, you're accepting of the unexpected or the new.
Right, exactly. And it's more like, this is why it's more like a child. I used an example in that blog about a child presenting something for the first time to his classmates. And he was presenting something about something that it was about stuttering, I think, in the blog. And he was presenting his stuttering as if it was just this thing that he did. And he was learning how to use these strategies to try to stop himself from doing it. And the other children in the group were like, oh, really? You stutter. So is that fun to stutter, or does it hurt? You know, they had these really kind of open questions about it that as adults, you know, we know what stuttering has this emotional basis, and there's and it's stigmatizing, and there's something wrong with it. So there's this openness to the possibility, yeah. I think, that the beginner's mind has. So if you're so that you can see options for differential ways to behave in a situation, to approach recovery. If you have a situation where, you know, you usually do the same thing over and over again, think about what's something else you could do that gives you the same result, but it doesn't have the emotionality attached to it.
Okay. And how can you cultivate beginner's mind?
Well, I think meditation and mindfulness is helpful for that. And I think it's also listening. Because a lot of times when we're emotionally overwrought going into recovery meetings, we don't want to listen.
Okay.
And it's very important to listen and to take take in everything, all the different ideas that are coming at you. And especially in recovery, just because it's such a high stakes thing that can be life or death for people.
Sure.
It gets hard for people to remain open. And yeah. And especially if somebody did AA and that worked for them and it saved their life, then it has to work for you because it saved my life. You see, that is not beginner's mind. That's just thinking it's all about me and my perspective. Your perspective doesn't really, you know, it can't be right because this worked for me.
Sure.
And that's not beginner's mind.
Yeah. Okay. What's compartmentalization and how can that be problematic?
Compartmentalization. Yeah. You know, it's something that all humans do. I mean, we do. I was just talking about driving. You know, we have this little compartment in our mind. Here's this habit that we do, and this is how we do it. You know, and it's this combination of different behaviors that we kind of put into this little box.
Yeah.
And the same thing happens, I think, with our addiction, especially when it's something that's stigmatizing and you know, people. We know that it's helping us and it's giving us something that we're not getting from somewhere else. But we also notice that it's something that people don't approve of. And maybe sometimes we don't approve of it either because it's making us, you know, getting us into trouble or whatever it is. So we'll put it in a little box off to the side. So it's there when we need it, you know, we can go and get it. But nobody else needs to know about it. And, you know, it's just our little secret, right? And people, you know, it's good to when you recognize that. That's where honesty really becomes a powerful thing because you start to out yourself and you start to tell people about the little box and you start to do that too. And it's important, but the problem in when you have it in that little box, it starts to leak out of the box and it starts to like encompass you in these ways that you're not really aware of. And everybody else starts to become aware of it before you are when you're getting into trouble. And in recovery, the comparison I was making in recovery, we often say, okay, you're getting sober now, and this thing is taking control over your life and all these different aspects, your addiction, and now we want you to go into recovery. So go to these meetings and you'll recover, or take naltrexone or something for the urges, and then you'll hopefully be able to recover it. There's all these little compartments of different, and people often assign their what's helped them in their recovery to these different methods instead of being, oh, it's like beginner's mind again. Instead of being open to everything, it's kind of like, well, this is where my recovery is. I go to that meeting every Tuesday night, and that's what's keeping me sober. Well, it may or may not be, but if it's not really, if your recovery isn't really encompassing your life holistically and bleeding into a lot of different parts of it, if you're just not drinking, for instance, if you're an alcoholic, that's not going to work.
That's not enough.
It's just, yeah, it's just in this one little compartment. That's where your recovery is. And the rest of your life is still in disarray the way it was before you started drinking.
Yeah. So integration is key then.
Integration is key. And, you know, there's this, I don't like this term, but, you know, the term dry drunk when somebody, my definition is just that somebody may have had some difficulties that they were using alcohol to manage. And then they got sober, but they didn't deal with any of the problems that they were having, the emotional problems, or they didn't get therapy or anything. And so and often people say, you know, he used to be a drunk asshole. Now he's just an asshole. It's like a version of it. But that's kind of compartmentalization too. And it's important when you go into recovery, you're transforming your life. So, and it used to be this habit that you had that filled this thing in you, that you didn't feel whole and you needed something to fill this hole. And then when you move out of recovery, that hole is still there. And if you don't fill it with something compelling and fulfilling and helping you have a more productive, happy life, then it's going to come back.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. What is your understanding of the middle way and how might that relate roughly to what we've been talking about today?
I think the middle way, you know, the middle path, the middle way, it is important because it's beyond extremes.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that, you know, what one of the biggest things that gets people in trouble in early recovery is strong emotions, particularly like frustration and anger and rage. And they can be triggered by that easily, as well as by sadness and grief. And you know, those types of emotions, or extreme elation, you know, something really great happens, you win the lottery, and then all of a sudden you're at the bar celebrating, you're like, whoa, I'm not supposed to be, you know. Yeah. Things, when we get into extreme emotional states, we lose our balance, and it's easy for the old habit behaviors to sneak in. And when you're in the middle way, to me, it's about balance. You know, you're balanced between you're not upset, you're not angry, but you're not elated. And this is what they call, you know, a lot of people in Buddhism, they call it genuine happiness. It's not that I'm not, you know, overblowing with joy and hysterically jumping up and down because things are so great. No, I'm just happy. When you think about a child, right? Children generally are not angry and pissed off. I mean, sometimes they're crying because they want to get their needs met. But in terms of their general state, when they're just resting, they're not angry. You know, that's not a natural state for people to be in. So I think the middle way is more about being in the natural state of you as your core being, you know, who you actually are.
Yeah. Okay. If people wanted to find out more about your work, how would they go about it?
Well, they can write me. I mean, I don't really do that much except the meetings that I do. So you could go to smartrecovery.org or smartne.org, which is the New England chapter of Smart Recovery. And there's meeting lists there where people could find the meetings that I'm at, or they could contact me through my email that you have.
Well, it's been really great talking to you today, Matt. Absolutely fascinating. And thank you very much for giving up your time.
No problem. Thank you so much, Barry, and for all the work you're doing.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.